This is Daniela Cambone. Welcome back to the Daniela Cambone Show, now on ITM Trading. Well, my guest today says expect the stock market to retreat, a recession to strike, and inflation to fall below 2%. Joining me today is Professor Steve Hanke. He's a professor of applied economics at Johns Hopkins University, and he's a former economic advisor to Ronald Reagan. Professor, always good to be with you. Welcome back.
Great to be with you, Daniela.
So let's see, reading your recent remarks, you expect the stock market to retreat, a recession to strike, and inflation to drop below 2% by the end of the year. My opening question to you, Professor, is how will this all be possible?
Well, if you look at the data coming in today, you have to say, what's this guy smoking, you know? The economy looks pretty good. The stock market is roaring away, and inflation, although it continues to come down, contrary to the reports we were getting a couple of days ago, it actually fell from 3.4% year over year to 3.1%, and it will go down to 2% or below by the end of this year. So that's the inflation part of the thing. The stock market is really difficult to predict, but it's usually related to recessions. And recessions and economic activity do play a role in the stock market because earnings and free cash flow are generated from economic activity. And we think a recession is baked in the cake. John Greenwood and I, who I work with on this, these kinds of things, think a recession is baked in the cake for later this year. Now, if that happens, the stock market will come down because free cash flows will come down, earnings will come down, and multiples, which are very high, will adjust and come down. Now, why do I say this is all baked in the cake and I'm so certain about it? I'm certain about it because with Greenwood, are using the quantity theory of money. That is the theory behind what's determining the course of the economy. Nominal GDP, and remember, nominal GDP has two components, the price level and real rates of growth. So rates of growth in prices and rates of growth in inflation. If you add those two together, you get nominal GDP. And it's very accurate to use the quantity theory and predict what's going to happen with nominal GDP. So why is it difficult for people to get their head around this? It's difficult because there are big lags between changes in the money supply and changes in asset prices, changes in economic activity, and ultimately changes in inflation. So it's the lags that are the problem. And when I say baked in the cake, all of this was baked in the cake a year and a half or 2 years ago when the money supply started going south and has been in negative territory. It's down about 4.5% since March of 2022. That's a big slide. It's only happened. That kind of thing has only happened four times in American history, and the biggest one, of course, we had to get to the 4.5% level to get down that low in a contraction. You have to go back to 1929-1933. We had a big contraction then, and you know what happened? We had a Great Depression. We had a much bigger contraction, by the way, than the current one. But in any case, all these four cases, when you go way back and look at the contractions that have occurred, we have always seen that they've been followed by a recession. And that's why I'm saying and think the recession is baked in the cake, because we've had this big contraction, and contractions always lead to slowdowns in nominal GDP.
Help me understand this, Professor. So two points, right? Baked in the cake, unless there were to be a reversal in the money supply. I mean, could not another crisis hit and all of a sudden...
That's true. That's true. But remember, the big lags that occur. Even if the money supply was reversed today, it would take a year and a half or 2 years before that would show up in the economy. These things aren't like turning a switch on. And the lags are long and variable, which makes it very difficult to pinpoint exactly when things are going to go south or when they're going to boom. For example, let me give you an example. Greenwood and I originally, once we saw that the Fed had switched into reverse and started contracting the money supply, we thought that we would have a recession by the end of last year. That was our original prediction. It turned out to be wrong. We were way ahead of things. And the reason for that is that there had been such a huge buildup in excess money created with the huge expansion in the money supply that led to this big excess and inflation, which we got the inflation part right, by the way. We said inflation would go up to 9%. It went up to 9.1%. So the inflation thing we got right. The recession thing we didn't get right. And the reason was this big excess was draining off and coming back to a normal level at a much slower rate than was typical. So once Greenwood and I saw that, we changed our forecast. And instead of the end of 2023, the recession arriving, we did a reforecast for the end of 2024. And we did that because of looking at the data, and the data were changing. And to quote John Maynard Keynes, if the data change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? Or I should say madam.
Okay.
So
help me make, sorry,
so,
please.
So the lags are tricky. That's what's tricky about the thing.
The second point I want to bring up, I want you to help me make sense of it for the folks at home, right? Because you mentioned the strong economy and we see the headlines that we're being told. The jobs numbers, consumer confidence, great. But on the flip side, we hear, you know, we're seeing all the layoff numbers, you know, Paramount just yesterday, 800 jobs, Cisco, Instacart, Wayfair. I mean, the list goes on here of job cuts, job cuts, job cuts. You know, you're talking about a recession. So, and I would argue that most people, you know, whenever they hear, oh, it's a strong economy, you know, the first pushback I get is like, for whom? Not for the middle and low income class here. So help us make sense of the reality today of the economy. Because like I said, most people are saying, they keep telling a strong economy, but they're not feeling it or seeing it.
Okay, that's a good point, because if you kind of look at the headline numbers for the job market, for example, the unemployment rate, if that's all you were looking at, it's down pretty low. But if you look under the hood at more detail of what's going on in the economy, weakness is starting to show up in as you get out in the weeds and drill down in things. You see that headline number is a little bit of a mirage, if you will. Things are starting to turn south already. So I would argue that the labor market's probably weaker than the headline that's advertised. And remember, you have a lot of political propaganda that comes out of Washington, D.C., the Federal Reserve, the White House, et cetera, et cetera. And the headline that they have and the message and narrative that they have is that everything looks great. And they point to things like the stock market. The stock market, you know, that's an objective number. The stock market indices, that's for real. And the unemployment rate, it's a real number. But again, looking forward and looking under the hood, you find that things aren't really quite as rosy as a headline would let you make you believe. That's basically my thinking.
Exactly. So things are not as good as they seem. And to your point on inflation, right? Because I'm sure you get the pushback. Well, we're not seeing. Look, even the president talking shrinkflation during the Super Bowl, but they're not feeling prices coming down.
No, they're not. They're not feeling prices coming down because number one, they're still going up. The rate at which they're going up is slowing down. Or the rate that they were going up at the peak was 9.1%, but now we're talking about 3.1%. So the rate of increase is slowing. It's not going up as fast as it was, but it is going up. Point number one, that's the rate of increase. The level of prices is another thing, and the level of prices is a lot higher than it was in 2020, before all this started, and that's what people realize. They think in terms of, well, what were things costing 2 or 3 years ago, and they were costing a lot less than they're costing right now, because we've had this huge run up in prices, and the price index, including everything, all 300 plus items that are in the consumer price index. They literally have all gone up in the last couple of years.
On the topic of the Fed and political propaganda we're consuming, I'm sure you caught Fed Chair Powell's discussion on 60 Minutes. I want to get your take on, he rarely gives interviews, obviously felt the need to explain what's happening with rates. So your insights on what the Fed is doing right now, Professor.
Okay, well, the Fed, we have to start. What is the narrative that they put out? Let's just walk through this point by point, kind of a lecture type thing. What is the narrative? The narrative that's being put out by the Fed and the White House on this inflation cycle that we've had and run up in prices is that these inflation bursts that we've seen have all been created by two things, either problems that we've had in the supply chain or problems that we have had with commodity prices going up as a result of, usually they say, the war in Ukraine. They put it on kind of the Russian back. So that's the narrative. And the narrative never includes changes in the money supply. That's left out. Now, I have, by the way, about 2 weeks ago, there was a big lead article signed by four journalists in the New York Times. Their top four reporters on finance and economics signed off on this article, and it gave this standard narrative, and that is all this inflation talk is all about non-monetary things. They mentioned supply chain, commodity prices, all kinds of ad hoc things that, by the way, have nothing to do with the Fed or the White House. These are external shocks that came into the system and caused the inflation. Washington didn't cause the inflation. The Fed didn't cause inflation. And that's just nonsense. Inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. They never talk about changes in the money supply. So let's get to the money supply. What is the money supply? The money supply, broadly measured, M2, is made up of the following things. Currency makes up about 11% of it. About 76% is made up of deposits at commercial banks. About 5% are small time deposits at commercial banks, and about 8% is made up of money market funds, retail money market funds. That is what the money supply is. Now, what happened to the money supply? After February of 2022, it shot up. And by February of 2023, it had gone up. it was peaking at about 27% year over year, the rate of growth. Now, a rate that's consistent with hitting a Fed inflation target of 2% is about 6%. So you can see it was, you know, almost four times higher than what I call Hanke's golden growth rate, 6%, a rate for growth that would be consistent with hitting 2%. So what happened? As Greenwood and I predicted, inflation went up. We said it would go up as high as 9%. Well, it went up to 9.1%. Now, how do we know this? We know this because money is the fuel for the economy, and the quantity theory of money is a theory you use to analyze what's going to happen with nominal GDP, the changes in prices plus changes in real GDP, and there's a proportionality between rates of change in the money supply and inflation. I did a study that was published in World Economics in September of last year. I looked at 139 countries between 1990 and 2021, and I looked simply at the rate of growth in the money supply and the rate of growth in prices in those 139 countries over that 1990 to 2021 period. And what did I find? I found something very close to proportionality, and that is, I didn't get a one-to-one relationship, but the correlation was 0.97. It was almost one-to-one. You change a money supply by 1%, you get a 1% change in the price level. Or 10%, you get a 10% change. So money is the thing that's not in the narrative. If you read the newspapers and the financial press, you have to remember Hanke's 95% rule. 95% of what you read is either wrong or irrelevant. Now, why is it wrong, and why is it so systematically wrong in this inflation cycle? Because the press is bought into completely the narrative that's been handed to them by the Fed. And there's a complement. European Central Bank and the Bank of England have exactly the same narrative. The other central banks around the world don't. But the other central banks around the world don't have the kind of inflation problems, the big ones anyway, that we've had. In other words, to make a long story short, the Fed lies. And why does the Fed lie? Because they don't want the noose around their neck for being the culprit that caused inflation. And they say it's all because of oil prices, commodity prices, supply chain problems, all these other things that have nothing to do with the Fed.
And Professor, does it become amplified because it's an election year? I mean, do they not want to be blamed for how the course cycle will take?
They never want to be blamed. Now, this is typical, by the way, of all central banks. So all central banks do this. When inflation comes out, they come up with some non-monetary reason for why the inflation occurred. Wage price increases, oil price increases, supply chain problems, you name it. They'll have a million things, and they'll never talk about changes in the money supply, which is something that's their responsibility, is changes in the money supply and monetary policy. The election year does magnify that because, when people go to the polls, and one of the big problems they have is inflation, and they know very well. I can remember just earlier this week, I went to the grocery store to buy a box of cereal, and the thing was like $7. This was Quaker Oats, and I was talking about sticker shock. So yes. That's what's facing everybody all the time, or buying new tires for their car, or getting a repair job, or clothes, or whatever it is. They know they're paying a lot more than they were 3 years ago. That's all it's registering, and they don't register that, oh, things are getting better. we were at 9.1% inflation year over year, and now we're only at 3.1. They don't think about that.
No.
All they know is what they pay when they go to the store.
Exactly. Exactly.
So this is a big problem for all the incumbent politicians, and it's a big problem for the Fed, but the Fed's done a pretty good job, by the way, of changing this narrative and getting the noose out off their neck.
Another, you know, talking point of Powell's during the interview was about the banking crisis. So I want to get your thoughts. He said it's unlikely we will see another real estate-led banking crisis. And now Federal Reserve Vice Chair for Supervision Michael Barr just said this week that recent turmoil in the regional banking sector is not indicative of problems in the broader banking system. Professor, your thoughts on the health of the U.S. banking sector right now? Could we see another crisis?
Well, let me tell you why they're peddling the crisis story first. Barr at the Fed wants to increase the regulations on banks. And he wants, in particular, to increase the capital asset ratios of banks. He wants them more capitalized. So that's why they're peddling this crisis thing. Bankers are dangerous. Bankers are bad. We had this remember the great financial crisis in 2008 when Lehman went under and the subprime mortgage crisis. What did we have? We had a whole host of new bank regulations with Dodd-Frank to tighten the screws on banks. And what happened with banks? The loans of banks went down. The money supply started shrinking because the bank loans went down. So what they're doing, they want to regulate banks more. They want the capital asset ratios to go up at banks. And to do that, they have to have a narrative that justifies more regulation. And they have to tell us that banks are unsafe and we're going to have a crisis if they don't regulate them more. That's what the whole thing is about. Now, from a monetary policy point of view, this is total stupidity because this will shrink the money supply even more because loans are actually flat now. Loans have not been growing in the United States. And what does that mean? That means the contribution, the biggest contribution to the money supply is the credit created by commercial banks. Remember when I said the definition of M2, 76% of it were deposits at banks. Now, how do you get those deposits? Well, one big way you get them is when a bank makes a loan to Daniela. What'd she do? You increase your deposit at the bank, and that increases the money supply. So 76% of M2, the broadest measure of money in the United States, is made up of deposits at banks, and those are created by banks. Most people just don't get this, that who creates most of the money in the economy? Commercial banks do. Remember, 11%, only 11% is created by currency. That's the Fed. The Fed directly creates currency. Notes and coins are created by the Fed. That's 11%. The 76% is largely created by commercial banks. It's created privately.
So what's your take when you know, some experts say, well, we still need some flushing out of, you know, at the regional bank level. There's way too many banks.
I think this is a great exaggeration. I think a massive exaggeration. And these regulations will make things worse, not better. The regulations might create a crisis or more problems in these mid-sized banks. And the reason for that, by the way, is that if you increase the capital asset ratio of a bank, how does the bank adjust and meet those new requirements? It can issue new capital, but if they don't want to do that, because if they issue new capital, that dilutes the existing shareholders. So they're not inclined to do that. So they go to the denominator of the capital asset ratio and they try to shrink that. And that means to shrink loans, not to turn over loans, not to extend credit.
Do you think the mindset should be like, well, look, if you have, you know, over $220,000 in deposits in a bank, that maybe you should just avoid regional banks? Like, why take on that risk?
Well, I mean, that is one way to avoid it. If you don't want any risk in your deposits, you spread it around so they're all covered. I mean, de facto, they are, as we find out in the last crisis, de facto, they are all covered. But de jure, they are not. So if you are concerned about the risk associated with your deposits because they're too large and some of them are uncovered, you know, you open another bank account and spread it around.
Professor, I know you've been obviously writing a lot about Argentina, and I'd love for you to share some of your thoughts about what you think, you know, your assessment really of Milei and, you know, his shock measures, as they call it, that he's doing to the economy there. I mean, I'm sure you caught his speech in front of the World Economic Forum where he urged, you know, the Davos elite to reject socialism. Your thoughts on Milei and what he's doing for Argentina?
Okay, so first of all, Argentina is in a mess, and they've been in a mess for quite some time, and I know a little bit about it because I was President Carlos Menem's advisor from 1989 to 1999. So my take on the thing is as follows. The inflation rate, which I measure every day in Argentina, is 199% per year. So if Milei doesn't get that down, he's basically toast. He has a lot of good ideas about deregulating the economy, privatizing the economy, liberalizing the economy, getting rid of a lot of these really insane regulations that they have in Argentina. So all of that's fine. All of that's great. He's had a big pushback on his omnibus bill, which he had a whole host of reforms that were contained in that bill. Basically, the Congress threw it out, threw it back in his lap. So why doesn't he do what he should do as step one? And step one is to dollarize the economy, get rid of the central bank, something that I proposed originally in 1981, and also get rid of the peso, which I actually drafted a law for President Menem in 1999 to dollarize the economy and get rid of the peso. So that's what he should have done as step one, because that would have killed inflation, that would have given him credibility and political support, which would have allowed him to push through many of these needed reforms to liberalize the economy. Unfortunately, his Minister of Economy, Luis Caputo, has not followed that course of action. He's got the sequence of things all wrong. He's basically following an IMF sequence. He's trying to balance the budget first and fix everything in the economy first, and then get around to dollarizing after everything is fixed. Well, if everything is fixed, why in the world do you have to dollarize in the first place? I mean, I've done two of these dollarizations myself, one in Montenegro in 1999 and the other in Ecuador in 2000-2001. And there are no preconditions. You just do it. And that's what he should be doing. So my view is that he should be doing this and doing it now. Last week, Steve Forbes came out with a powerful interview on YouTube in which Forbes said exactly what I'm telling you, and Forbes has it exactly right. I think Milei has just missed the boat. He campaigned on dollarization, that he was going to get rid of the peso, he was going to get rid of inflation, he was going to use the U.S. dollar in Argentina, which, by the way, privately everybody does anyway, but he was going to do this officially, and he won the election because of that. And then all of a sudden, he takes a presidency, he appoints someone who's not a big fan of dollarization, Caputo, as his finance minister, and he's put dollarization on the shelf and isn't doing it. So I think he's made perhaps a fatal mistake in sequencing.
Speaking of fatal mistakes, I want to ask you if this could be one. I want to bring it back to the United States, to the election. And yes, Ukraine will be top of mind when it comes to the election. Your thoughts on Speaker Mike Johnson floating confiscating Russian assets to fund Ukraine war aid? He says it would be pure poetry, but insiders I've spoken to, professors, say this could potentially be catastrophic. What are your thoughts, and where do you sit?
All these aspects of weaponizing the financial system and the dollar system are bad news. I mean, basically, it's theft. So I don't think theft is a very good attribute. This is Washington BS, and the dogs of war are out, and they're financing this war. If we wanted the war to stop, and stop killing people and destroying Ukraine, the U.S. should cut off the funding and not fund it. It's the same in the Middle East. If you want the war in Gaza to stop, the U.S. has to stop funding it. Who's funding these things? And that's the tip of the iceberg, the funding, because they're sending weapons, they're sending involved in intelligence. The U.S. is being sucked into these things big time. And this is a dangerous course to be on. It's a treadmill, and it's not a good one to be on. A never-ending war is a bad thing. And we've been in a never-ending war since 9/11 in the United States. So this is a big problem and a big potential risk.
Risk to the dollar, to World War III, risk to what?
All of the above. You never know. I'm not predicting, because Daniela, it's like flipping a coin. The coin is in the air, and I'm not in the business of telling you whether it's going to land heads or land tails. Well, once you're engaged in a never-ending war, the coin is up in the air, and no one, by the way, has a very good idea of how it's going to land.
Well said, Professor. Just a final thought from you. A big chunk of our audience obviously interested in the gold market, wondering, is gold doing what it should be doing? Should it be higher? Your assessment of the gold market.
My own view is that it's going higher.
Based on everything happening, obviously.
Well,
the geopolitical tensions,
there are many factors. The most blatant one is that central banks are continuing to buy quite a bit of it. And why are they buying it? Well, they're buying it because of these risks and this weaponizing of the U.S. financial system and the U.S. dollar. I mean, I think the weaponization aspect is. That's obviously why China is loading up and why Russia is loading up. It goes without saying.
Professor, I thoroughly appreciate your time. I know you gave us lots of it today. I felt like I was in one of your lectures today. I just love learning from you. So I thank you. It's truly a gift. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be with you. Have a great day.
Thank you, Professor, and thank you all for watching. We'll have more great content coming your way, so be sure to stay tuned to the Daniela Comboni Show here on ITM Trading. Thanks for tuning in.